man.
Every so often, a single event sends up a flare, revealing where everyone in an industry truly stands. My expose on Mike Israetel's doctoral thesis was one of those moments. The fallout has been significant, and in many ways, the response from certain established figures in the fitness industry has been more revealing than the initial issue. While many have weighed in, the defensive reactions of two prominent figures in the fitness industry, Mike Israetel himself and Lane Norton, serve as perfect case studies for a much larger dynamic at play. Their responses, though different in form, are united by a common theme, an attempt to discredit the messenger to avoid the substance of the message. In this video, I'll deconstruct their arguments. In Chapter 2, I'll provide an overview of Mike Israetel's response to my critique. In Chapter 3, I'll offer a point-by-point refutation of his claims. I'll highlight his logical fallacies, and most importantly, his glaring omissions. From there, I'll pivot to Lane Norton. Chapter 4 will present Lane's brief but telling comment in full, while Chapter 5 will provide a critical analysis of his position. In Chapter 6, I'll contemplate why these exchanges matter for the future of evidence-based fitness. Finally, I'll conclude in Chapter 7. To understand the subsequent fallout, we must first revisit the key events of the original debacle before analyzing Mike Israetel's formal response. The scandal unfolded in two acts. First, there was the initial defense. In response to my critique of his sloppy PhD thesis, Mike Israetel claimed that I had reviewed a mistakenly uploaded draft copy.
We now know Solomon was looking at an accidentally uploaded, incorrect, rough draft. So I'll say this, I don't blame him for going hard on it because he has every reasonable idea to think this was the final draft. It wasn't. We have the final draft now in the link here. And so most of his critiques are just non-starters because the final just doesn't have most of those problems. However, the final is not perfect at all. And it absolutely has some referencing inconsistencies. It absolutely has some typos in there still. It's not a perfect document. I guess technically I submitted the wrong draft to the graduate school. And so that's been, being rectified now.
To support this claim, Mike produced a supposedly authentic 2013 version of the document, a version that was quickly identified as a modern fabrication.
I've lied. I've lied a lot.
I guess technically I submitted the wrong draft to the graduate school.
Lying is easy as hell. I can do it at the drop of a hat.
Second came the admission. Faced with irrefutable evidence, Mike Israetel retracted his story and admitted that the thesis that I had reviewed was, in fact, the one submitted for his PhD. It was in the aftermath of this admission that Mike began a campaign of damage control across multiple podcast appearances. His strategy was twofold: attack the messenger and minimize the message. A significant portion of Mike's defense focused not on the facts of the thesis, but on me personally. First, Mike questioned my motives. He framed my critique as a hit piece.
It's like a hit piece, right?
Done in bad faith.
Did the least charitable, most bad faith critique of it possible.
Solomon was doing this in maybe some combination of bad faith. Like, he just really wants to take me down.
So the group that puts out these critiques, Solomon Nelson, Lyle McDonald, Johnny Shreve type folks, they're just known for doing things in bad faith. And so I don't really ever take their criticism seriously.
By someone who's not really after the truth.
This guy is like a lawyer or something. I don't think he's a trained scientist. He's not really after the truth or after revealing wisdom or anything.
He dismissed my analysis as having a lawyer-like attitude as opposed to a scientific one.
Mr. Solomon Nelson's coming at it, all due respect, in bad faith. He wants to take me down, so he's not interested in taking an impartial objective view. He's interested in taking a lawyer-like attitude of scalpel-like incision.
He also claimed that my primary motive was cynical and commercial, stating that my videos about him get 10 to 20 times the views and thus money.
So this person is a person who gets roughly 10 to 20 times the views and thus money by critiquing myself and other major influencers in fitness like Jeff Nippard, for example.
Right.
And so they're highly incentivized to do it. It's like the exact same model that Greg Doucette uses. You know, for these guys, sort of critique videos of me do way, way better than all the other videos on the channel. And it just makes sense that they would make more of them. So I have zero loss for these dudes. Make these videos. It's totally dope. Ask the conversation. I can dish it out.
Second, Mike questioned my associations. He linked me to my friend, Lyle McDonald, whom he called one of the most bad faith actors in all of fitness.
He has a gentleman who's in a lot of videos with him. His name is Lyle McDonald. And this is like a person who is like maybe like one of the most bad faith actors in all of fitness.
In a clear attempt at establishing guilt by association. When not attacking my character, Mike pivoted to reframing my criticisms as trivial, context-dependent, or irrelevant. First, Mike gave the one-third of his PhD defense. He argued that his PhD was unique, consisting of one-third coursework, one-third practical coaching, and only one-third dissertation.
In my PhD program, the dissertation was one-third of the PhD. It's a very unique PhD program.
And was therefore in the bottom 10th percentile for research quality by design.
So as far as research quality and throughput, my PhD is at the bottom, I don't know, 5th, 10th percentile, like it's at the bottom 10th percentile of all PhDs in related fields, for sure.
Second, Mike gave the clerical error defense. He insisted that the hundreds of errors I spotted were exclusively clerical.
And it had like some formatting stuff, like the citations were formatted weird. And all that stuff. So it's basically it was exclusively clerical errors.
And that he simply flubbed the submission.
What ended up happening was I flubbed the submission to the graduate school.
By copy-pasting tables with a one-off offset.
So instead of copying and pasting into all these cells, I did it like a one-off offset.
An error he claims he was unaware of for 12 years.
But you knew it was wrong.
Oh, no, I didn't know it was wrong until it was surfaced to me 12 years later.
Third, Mike gave the context defense. He argued that my critique was unfair because his thesis is 12 years old.
Okay, slow clap. You criticized a dog. You're like my first piece of like writ large scale academic work 12 years ago. Congratulations. Slow clap. You're the fucking man. Like scuzzy bitch move, right?
Was never meant for public distribution.
And so it was never meant for public distribution. So I was like,
and was intended for coaches, not evidence-based fitness nerds.
The folks that follow Solomon's channel are in evidence-based fitness. Yeah. And so their prerequisite understanding of physiology and anatomy is very high. And all love and respect, but there is a spectrum of sport coaches' understanding of anatomy and physiology. And then if you have something like the papers off of my dissertation to give them and explain to them in very plain language, and the coaches would read that and be like, oh, holy shit.
He even questioned if it was ethical for me to have obtained it.
So actually, I have no idea how he got it. I don't even know if it's ethical for him to have that document.
Last, Mike gave the, well, the substance of my thesis was good defense. He argued that the underlying ideas of his research were sound and not obvious at the time, making the presentation issues secondary.
But one of the, I believe one of the criticisms was something like, okay, so like his dissertation shows that like bigger athletes are stronger and that stronger athletes like run faster. Like, isn't that obvious? Well, at the time that we were doing our dissertation, it was not obvious on two fronts. It was illustrated that lower body fat percentages led people to sprint faster and jump higher. Now, an immediate implication of that to coaches would be like, How are your athletes' diets? But here's the thing. Even within the sample of human athletes, that was true. And they're all pretty lean and pretty jacked. If you look at that data set in our study of 88 Division I athletes, you start to be like, oh, holy shit, even for these people, working on your nutrition and working on your weight training matters. Many, many people are under the illusion that at elite levels of athletics, at high levels, getting jacked doesn't pay dividends. It'll slow you down. Getting leaner, we're not trying to step on stage. Who cares how they look? There is wisdom in that as well, because at the extremes, all that stuff breaks down. But what is evident in the dissertation that I wrote at the time is even at those high levels, it matters how lean you are and how jacked you are. And it helps every measurable quality of sport performance.
Mike is also now arguing that his credentials never really meant much in the first place.
Credentials are kind of bullshit to begin with.
Yeah.
I think the term credibility is actually to begin with. Yeah.
Most revealing, however, is what was left unsaid. Across multiple lengthy interviews, Mike Israetel never once addressed the central, most damning part of the entire scandal. His fabrication of a fraudulent document in an attempt to cover up the initial problem. Mike, though a poor forger, is a brilliant actor. After his forced admission, he adopted a posture of humility while simultaneously launching a campaign to deflect, minimize, and misdirect. Let's deconstruct it. Although Mike's personal attacks are a clear diversion from the facts, I'll address them anyway. Mike's primary accusation is that my critique is a bad faith commercial ploy. However, my videos about Mike being popular isn't proof of my bad faith. It's just proof that the public is hungry for accountability. Mike is, in effect, blaming me for the newsworthiness of his own scandal. This position is made even more absurd by his own admission that on the Renaissance Periodisation channel, he makes similar videos on celebrities.
And I would be a massive hypocrite if I didn't say that on the RP Strength channel, we didn't do videos about celebrity athletes and stuff like that, that also did that.
And that this is all 100% part of the game.
It is all 100% part of the game.
Mike can't simultaneously mega respect the game while also using it as a shield to imply that my critique is invalid. By labeling my work as a hit piece, Mike preemptively dismisses the evidence as if it barely matters. Next, Mike resorted to guilt by association, linking me to Lyle McDonald, whom he calls one of the most bad faith actors in all of fitness. This is an attempt to poison the well. By linking me to a figure he frames as a villain, he implies I'm also one by proxy, which is a rhetorical smokescreen designed to appeal to tribalism, and it has absolutely zero bearing on the veracity of my claims. After trying to discredit my motives, Mike pivoted to minimizing his errors with a series of excuses. He first offered the one-third PhD defense, arguing that his doctorate was unique and that the dissertation was only one-third of the work, placing it in the bottom 10th percentile for research quality by design.
In my PhD program, the dissertation was one-third of the PhD. It's a very unique PhD program.
This excuse doesn't make sense. It's true that PhDs can have coursework components, but the idea of the coursework isn't to diminish the quality of the research. The PhD is an internationally recognized research qualification. Mike did a PhD, not a professional doctorate. Throughout the world, the PhD testifies to the candidate's ability to conduct research. The thesis produced through the research, with the supplementation of coursework, has to demonstrate research ability at a doctoral level. If East Tennessee State University really says that the thesis only represents 33% of the degree, okay, well then that still doesn't mean that it's supposed to be one-third of the quality of a standard thesis. It might mean that the dissertation doesn't have to be as long as a dissertation that's 100% of the degree. It doesn't mean that an East Tennessee State University thesis can get away with being one-third as good. I think that East Tennessee State University will have to decide if it really wants to back Mike on this one. Is it really running a toy PhD program where candidates can earn the qualification with a thesis that has only one third of the thinking power of a standard doctoral thesis? That strikes me as improbable, because if true, then the reputation of the university would collapse. Mike then tried the clerical error defense, claiming that the hundreds of mistakes I spotted were exclusively clerical, and that he simply flubbed the submission by copy-pasting tables with an offset he somehow didn't notice for 12 years.
So instead of copying and pasting into all these cells, I did it like a one-off offset?
First, Mike's one-off offset narrative makes no sense when you look at the corrupted tables in his thesis. In tables 4.6, 4.7, and 5.4, what Mike appears to have done is copy the mean figures from the highest performers and paste them into the standard deviation cells for the lowest performers. A one-off offset doesn't explain this, because it would presumably affect all similar data points. However, in all three erroneous tables, the highest performers' standard deviation columns appear correct and contain plausible values. Why would a repeated shift by one error only corrupt the lowest performers' standard deviation columns while leaving the highest performers' standard deviation columns untouched in every single instance? This makes Mike's one-off offset explanation highly improbable. Second, Mike's claim that the errors I spotted were exclusively clerical, consisting of a misplaced negative sign on a few correlations and a table pasting misalignment, is a gross minimization. At a certain point, clerical errors on such an enormous scale aren't a simple whoops, but reflect a systemic lack of care antithetical to doctoral level work. Mishandling data in tables, the very results of the research, right? That isn't just a typo. It's a corruption of the researcher's findings. Mike's excuse that the oral defense is what truly matters is also false.
Most people, and I think he's from Australia or something like that, most people Europe, in Europe and Australia, they have that other style of PhD where it's the dissertation is functionally 90% of your PhD. And so even though technically you're only graded on the oral defense and not on the document.
So he values it way differently.
So you know, if my dissertation was that big of a fraction of my PhD, every question he's asking is f-ing right on. Like, how did this pass?
The written dissertation is the permanent archive of the research, the artifact that is published and cited. The oral defense is a test of that document, not a replacement for it. Further, we have no idea how rigorous the oral exam was at East Tennessee State University, but if it were anything like as thorough as the examination of the written text, then it wouldn't bear scrutiny. It looks as if anything passes among friends in that room. With Mike's genius for smooth talking, I'm sure everyone was seduced. But what do we have in the hand that testifies that his doctoral work was worth anything? The evidence is only in that thesis. Ultimately, no matter what the degree structure, the credibility of the PhD hinges upon the text that gains the approval at the university. Third, and most revealingly, Mike's explanations for these clerical errors often appear to be post hoc fabrications themselves. When asked how he failed to notice the red squiggly lines under his misspellings, he offered a seemingly clever explanation. His typos were actual words that spellcheck missed, like writing science as sense, spelt S-E-N-S-E.
Because I'm like, if you did this on Word, you didn't notice the squiggly red line underneath?
For example, one of the typos is sense instead of science. Sense is another word, right, and you won't pick that up.
But this defense collapses under basic scrutiny. The actual error in Mike's thesis was spelling science as sense, spelt S-C-E-N-C-E, which is a non-word that proves his excuse is false. This small but telling inaccuracy functions as a microcosm for Mike's entire defense. It's an attempt to create a plausible-sounding narrative that simply doesn't align with the facts. Mike's context defense was equally flimsy. He argued that my critique was unfair because his thesis is 12 years old, was never meant for public distribution, and was intended for a different audience. But a PhD isn't a scuzzy piece of high school work.
On the other hand, like, if I took Solomon's work 12 years ago and looked for typos, people would rightfully consider it a scuzzy.
Let me get a hold of my sample.
It's a public, permanent, and searchable academic contribution. A PhD thesis doesn't have an expiry date, and its age certainly doesn't make it immune to criticism, especially when Dr. Mike is the foundational credential for Mike's entire career. His claim that it was for internal archive only is a distinction without a difference. It was submitted to his university, is held in their library, and is meant to be accessible. That's publication in an academic context. To then question if it were ethical for me to obtain this public record is a baseless intimidation tactic that I'll come back to soon. But first, let's address Mike's defense of his thesis's content, because it really is a masterful deflection. He claimed that I miscaricatured what a PhD is supposed to be.
Essentially, he miscaricatured what a PhD is supposed to be.
A word that, much like his data tables, doesn't quite exist. Mike then argued that his findings were significant, claiming his Division I athlete population was novel, and that his conclusions were valuable for coaches. This is where Mike's argument is most revealing. Mike's own university's PhD program states that it aims to produce pioneering research applied to coaching and produce transformational sports science research. Mike's defense conveniently latches onto the applied to coaching part while completely ignoring the pioneering and transformational part. He lets us believe that his work has practical utility, as if it's a substitute for an original contribution to knowledge. But a PhD thesis isn't a coaching manual. Showing that stronger, leaner athletes perform better, even in a Division I athlete population, isn't a groundbreaking, pioneering discovery. It is at best a replication of a banal fact. And how unlikely, anyway, that Mike's thesis could be applied to coaching when it's written in a garbled and pretentious language with obfuscatory formulae that no coach would ever use. A less practical item in the hand is hard to imagine. Further, a program that aims to elevate the academic status of coaches isn't served by a document riddled with nonsense tables and enormous scale typos. Such a document doesn't elevate coaches, it does the opposite. It drags the university's academic reputation down by reinforcing the worst stereotypes of academic incompetence. Mike is using the applied nature of his program as a smokescreen to hide his failure to be pioneering and his complete lack of academic rigor. Mike claims that, although his contentions may seem unremarkable today, they weren't so obvious in 2013. A good way to test that is to ask if anyone ever proposed the opposite theory. It's as if people 12 years ago thought that athletes who were fat and weak would sprint and jump better than athletes who were lean and strong. If the dissertation itself, across all six chapters, couldn't make the case for its own significance, then what chance does a panicked, post hoc, verbal defense on a podcast have of convincing us now? At the end of the day, we don't need to haggle about the rights and wrongs of Mike's thesis when the shame of having the thesis exposed drove Mike to a desperate attempt at forgery. In other words, it must have worried Mike so much to be seen to have produced a slipshod thesis that possibly would have failed at a reputable university that he resorted to a cover-up. He was so unnerved by having his slovenly platitudes shown for all to see that he falsified a document to hide the damage. But once again, Mike, though a poor forger, is a brilliant actor. After the admission, Mike picks up his pucker. When he concedes that the thesis that I'd reviewed was in fact the one that was examined at East Tennessee State University, he never entirely came clean. He didn't express contrition for a cover-up. He never actually said, "Sorry, I thought I could lie successfully, but the fib didn't wash, and I was forced to own up to my own fraudulence." Instead, Mike cunningly only referred to confusion over which draft got uploaded, thus erecting yet another baffling smokescreen. He has the gift of filibustering. It also didn't take long for Mike to recover his cocksure rhetoric. With shameless chutzpah, he even questioned my ethics. See how he regains his composure by trying to bury the scandal of the cover-up beneath bluff and blarney.
Solomon is a younger man, quite handsome, I must say. Solomon's a smart guy, and his followers are real smart.
And perhaps even deleting hundreds of comments, as per Scott Herman's analysis.
Scroll down. Only 400 comments. Even Alex, where are all the comments? Either deleting or filtering them. So these guys, his team, they are on a huge damage control right now, guys. Deleting comments. Imagine having to delete 2,000 comments off of your videos in order to try to do damage control. That is absolutely insane. You look at the amount of comments that are there compared to all of his content before Solomon dropped his piece. There is a lot of comments getting deleted. The views are down massively.
But most brazenly, he's starting to moralize. Mike, of all people.
I don't even know if it's ethical for him to have that document.
Come again? Sorry, what was unethical? Here is a piece of science. A piece of scientific research that contributes to knowledge so substantially that it earns you a doctorate. Suddenly, with Butterfly Mike, this piece of research is so fragile that it must never be handled by anyone. It has to be locked up in a glass case, and it would be unethical if someone else found the keys to the vitrine. What is this new definition of science that assumes an etiquette of privacy? A PhD is suddenly something that has to be secreted away from malevolent eyes and dirty hands. Does Mike not know that science is meant to exist in the public domain? Since when was it unethical for any member of the public to consult a body of science, especially when it's been through a supposedly rigorous process of review? So isn't this telling? Mike questions the ethics of getting hold of a doctorate that is supposed to be publicly available and that his own university posts as a significant contribution to knowledge. Apparently, the text is meant to be confined to a huddle, who probably hadn't even read it, but thought that it was propitious to pat Mike on the back without bothering themselves with further effort. Perhaps it would have been unethical, even for the examiners to read the thesis. Actually, that would explain a thing or two. How does Mike get away with this rubbish? If you ever want an example of filibustering, you have it here. Mike brandishing his falsified PhD, retracting it, and still managing to ascribe blame to the expositor for calling it out. In his recent podcast tour, Mike suddenly adopted a new talking point. I love this. That credentials are kind of bullshit.
Credentials are kind of bullshit to begin with.
And credibility is actually dog shit.
Yeah.
I think the term credibility is actually dog to begin with.
This is coming from the man who built his entire empire on the Dr. Mike persona.
Dr. Mike, Dr. Mike, Dr. Mike, Dr. Mike, Dr. Mike, Dr. Mike here for RP Strength.
And PhD approved marketing.
What do you get when PhD sports scientists collaborate with pro bodybuilders? The most effective muscle growth training app ever made.
He's on record saying that his PhD was a really good idea because of the authority it confers.
Dr. Mike, geez, that's a big deal. And I've noticed that carries a lot of weight. So for me, only by signaling, if only by signaling, my PhD was a really good idea.
This is the core of Mike's strategy. He wants to have it both ways. When the PhD was a profitable signal for his brand, it was a really good idea. Now that the substance of that PhD is exposed as a liability, credentials are suddenly bullshit. He wants to keep the authority of the title while disowning the responsibility for the work that the title represents. If credentials mean as little as Mike now says, yet he openly admits how much he profited from his own, then he's admitting that his entire Dr. Mike brand is a calculated sham. across all his lengthy interviews, Mike Israetel never once addressed the central, most damning part of the entire scandal. He refers to his initial response as incredibly sloppy and kind of screwed up.
And so the response I gave was incredibly sloppy.
I tried to respond. I kind of screwed up the response.
But he conveniently fails to mention that his sloppy response was an active attempt to deceive the public by fabricating a clean 2013 version of the thesis. This is not a screw-up. It is not sloppy. It is fraud. Mike's entire defense is built on a foundation of omissions. He persuasively addresses the lesser charges of typos and sloppiness while strategically ignoring the greatest one, the active, intentional cover-up. Mike presents himself as a flawed but honest man who's not beyond criticism.
I'm not beyond criticism. I'm not beyond reproach. I'm just like a regular asshole who has a PhD.
All while concealing the single most unethical action he took in the entire affair. During the height of this confusion, many prominent figures chose to weigh in. It was in this context, in the comments section of Milo Wolf's video, Solomon Nelson, Worst of the Fitness Industry, that Dr. Lane Norton, PhD, offered his perspective. The comment, captured via screenshot by my friend Matt Randall before it was apparently deleted, reads as follows. Never even heard of this dude. Love these punks like him and Lyle sitting behind computers talking shit, despite never having tried to publish original research and having zero concept of it. I'm sure I'll be the next hit piece now. That's fine. Lyle already tried to cancel me and failed miserably 10 years ago. While seemingly no longer publicly visible, Lane's comment stands as a testament to an initial reflex, an impulse to close ranks against an outside critic before all the facts of the Israetel situation had come to light. Lane's comment is brief, but dense with rhetorical tactics that call for a careful unpacking. First is the classic ad hominem, a rhetorical tactic that Lane himself claims not to be a fan of.
Well, that's, you know, I don't like ad hominems.
Lane's comment isn't directed at the substance of my critique, but at my perceived identity, a punk who sits behind a computer talking shit. As if offensively taking up the cudgels for Mike, Lane deflects my argument by bashing the person who argues it. It's an attempt to dismiss the message by attacking the messenger. Lane alleges that I have no concept of research, but how does he know this? He's just said that he doesn't know who I am. Fine, he doesn't have to. But he knows enough about my content to assert with so much confidence that I talk shit and have zero concept of research. Is this a science guy talking? Lane must have very penetrating powers of perception to know so much about me when he hasn't even heard of me. Second is the appeal to a narrow, gatekept definition of authority. The core charge is that because I haven't tried to publish original research, I have zero concept of it. This is a category error. The role of a critic isn't the same as the role of a creator. A film critic need not be a director to offer a valid analysis of a movie. You don't have to be a chef to spot a fly in the soup. But since it seems to matter so much to Lane, my background is in philosophy and law, which are disciplines founded on analysis, logic, and the critical evaluation of texts. The greatest irony is that Lane himself has argued that one doesn't need a scientific degree to interpret research. He champions critical thinking as a democratized skill, yet here, he seems to see the lack of a specific credential as an insuperable barrier to contributing critical content. Third is Lane's preemptive framing of a negative response as a hit piece. This is a classic well-poisoning tactic, seeking to invalidate a counter-argument before it's even been made. But this label is a fiction, and my critique of Mike Israetel's doctoral thesis is the proof. My video was the opposite of a hit piece. It was a substantive analysis of a public academic document, focusing on its corrupted data, methodological flaws, and unoriginal conclusions. A genuine hit piece, the kind Lane seems to anticipate with such weary resignation, begins with malice and follows a predictable and tawdry script. It would eschew any discussion of methodology or p-values, and instead delve into dark things, like the murky waters of Lane's personal life. If I wanted to make that kind of video, then I might point to the public allegations that Lane was unfaithful to his wife.
I had an affair.
And you put it on...
One of the defenses, arguments used against me, was Lyle made my wife cry, which whether true or not is irrelevant. And I would ask you again, Lane, did she cry more when you left her and your kids for an Australian bikini chick?
I could then pivot to his physique, weaponizing online whispers about gynecomastia. Not as a matter of health, but as a dog whistle to question his integrity and his natural status. To complete the trifecta, I might engage in some amateur psychoanalysis, attempting to chalk up Lane's current online behavior with his well-documented experiences with past bullying.
I went through some pretty intense bullying as a kid. Now, I will say, I never got, like, beaten up or anything like that. But pretty much daily verbal assaults from a lot of the quote-unquote cool kids.
But I won't do any of that. Just as I engaged with Mike Israetel's PhD thesis, my interest here lies squarely in the realm of ideas. These other tactics are the work of a character assassin, not a critic, and I refuse to use them. Finally, Lane conflates criticism with cancellation. To frame a past disagreement with Lyle as a cancellation attempt is to misrepresent the intellectual debate that took place. Criticism isn't an attack on your right to exist. It's an evaluative engagement with your ideas. This portrayal of a critique as a personal, existential threat is more paranoiac than truthful. So concludes my response to Lane Norton. Lane's comment, like Mike's entire defense, is a microcosm of a larger struggle. It represents the mindset of what Scott Herman has identified as the old guard. The old guard isn't defined by age, but by an attitude, an insular belief that legitimacy is conferred only by a small, credentialed circle, and that criticism from outside the circle is inherently illegitimate. The problem is that the ground has shifted. The old top-down model, where experts talk and everyone else listens, is broken. The audience now has a voice. And as the Israetel affair showed, no one is smarter than all of us. The collective scrutiny of a public that knows how to think for itself is a powerful force for accountability. The audience is tired of experts who boast of the authority of science but then reject its foundational principle, that all claims are subject to review. Mike had a brief moment of forced graciousness, right after being caught, where he even acknowledged that my criticisms were fair. But as soon as he regained his confidence, he reverted to the old guard's formula. If you can't refute the message, then attack the messenger. Mike's claim that I act in bad faith for commercial gain misdiagnoses the situation for convenience. He interprets the effect, the popularity of my videos, as the cause of my critique. In reality, my popularity is merely a symptom. It's not evidence of my bad faith, but rather compelling evidence that the fitness audience has a hunger for accountability. My motive isn't to tear down experts, but to elevate the standard of debate for everyone. So where does this leave us? We have two influential figures, Mike Israetel and Lane Norton, who when faced with substantive criticism resorted to attacks on my motives, my credentials, and my character. Mike Israetel has constructed an elaborate narrative to minimize his thesis's failings while completely ignoring his fraudulent attempt to cover them up. Lane Norton, in a knee-jerk defense of his peer, contradicted his own stated beliefs on scientific literacy to dismiss a critique he hadn't even engaged with. For me, their responses have been instructive. They reveal a defensive posture common among an old guard, unused to having its authority questioned by a newly empowered and discerning public. Perhaps, then, they might take a moment to engage with the work of the punks they dismiss. They might discover that a public that demands accountability isn't a threat, but the greatest asset an evidence-based community can have.